All right, so tonight we're going to study from 1 Peter chapter 5, 1 through 6. If you want to begin turning there, that's going to be really kind of our sole passage tonight. And as you're doing that, let me just kind of review, as we've been studying the book of 1 Peter, that there's been really three major problems throughout this book that Peter's been dealing with. There's a problem of anger and jealousy that it brings up in chapter 2, the beginning of chapter 2. And you can imagine, you know by now, that these are Christians that are being persecuted. They're suffering for doing what is right. They're being blamed in connection with the burning of Rome. And of course, they're completely innocent. Well, you can imagine going through such persecution would lead to Christians becoming angry. But the interesting thing is, you would imagine the anger would be towards those persecuting them. Well, Peter reveals that there's anger and jealousy among the Christians. And so you can go back and look at that lesson we talked about. Number three, he brings up fleshly lust in chapter 2 as well. But interesting, he comes back to that in chapter 4. So there was a problem with fleshly lust. And I would imagine, in one regard, this was kind of their escape route. This is the way that they let loose of all of this persecution and anger and jealousy. And then the third, and this is really, if you want to highlight any of these three, this is the one that he's really been covering in the book, submission and suffering. And Peter really gives a very big challenge in Christianity. Not only are they to submit to certain ones as they suffer, he tells them that they are to submit to the very ones that are causing suffering in their life. And that's the last person you want to submit to. That's what Peter says when he talks about suffering for doing what is right. For that finds favor in the Lord. And so chapter 2, chapter 3, that continues on. And so as we get to later chapters, chapter 4 and 5, it kind of breaks up this way. Again, he brings up the problem of fleshly lust in the first six verses. You might remember in the middle of chapter 4, we talked about these standard exhortations. What we kind of come to know towards the end of these letters, these exhortations that are kind of rapid fire. What we talked about is kind of the small things. And because we hear these exhortations, we read about them in the New Testament so often, a lot of times we might just kind of forget about them. Just kind of ignore those standard exhortations. And we were encouraged back then not to do that. And then last time we talked about, again, bringing up the problem of suffering. And there he really emphasized suffering for doing what is right, not for what is wrong. And so in chapter 5, he brings up that final point, the suffering and the submission. But interesting, talks about the submission in a certain context. And that context is in the church leadership. Let's look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 1. As he says, therefore, I exhort the elders above you as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight. Not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, and not for sordid gain, but with eagerness. Nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. You younger men, likewise, be subject to your elders. And all of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. For God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he might exalt you at the proper time. So, in this submission, he talks about it in the context of the elders. He talks about it from both ends. That elders are to submit, but the congregation is to submit as well to the elders. Now, in this lesson, we're going to focus mostly on the submission of the elders. But I want us to understand that we also need to submit to them as they submit to us. And if we're able to do that, that's when it works really well. A few things I want to point out as we go and kind of look through this. Why all of a sudden does he bring up elders? Is this just something that, okay, before I close, I didn't want to talk about this, and so I'll bring it up now? Well, it's possible, but I really believe there's a lead into this. When you go up to chapter 4, at the end of chapter 4, where he's talking about suffering for doing what is right, you might remember we talked about that Peter always not only tells them what they need to do, but he talks about the motivation. The motivation for doing it. And part of that motivation is he takes them and he looks to the past. And what that motivation is, Jesus Christ and his suffering. Suffering for doing nothing himself, but for what we've done. And he also takes them to the future. And he looks at that unfading glory that we're going to receive. He talks about that judgment day. And look at the very end of chapter 4, and talking about suffering for doing what is right. Look at what he said. For it is time for judgment to begin with the household of God. He takes them to that day. He takes them to that judgment day. It is time to begin with the household of God. It begins with us first. And if it begins with us, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And I really believe, based on that statement, based on what he says, now he goes into chapter 5 and the elders. Because what? If it's going to begin with the household of God, then this submission within the church of God is going to be vital. If the church is going to be ready and going to be first. Verse 2, he says, shepherd the flock of God among you. This is such an important passage. It is parallel to what Paul wrote. Peter and Paul write the exact same thing when it comes to elders. And what he is describing here, as we know, is the work of elders. But out of this description of their work, their responsibility to the congregation, to the flock, come of elders. Number one, shepherd. Shepherd the flock of God which is among you. That is the word where we get the word pastor. And so, if you really look at the New Testament, the pastors are the elders. They're not the preachers. They're not the evangelists. They're the elders. And so if you are part of a church, if you're listening, and you're part of a church and you have a group of elders and you have a group of pastors or you have a pastor and they're separate, it was never that way in the New Testament. Some man came along and separated those. But as you look at this passage, you can see that the pastors, the shepherds, are the elders. And not only that, he also says that they are to exercise oversight. And that oversight responsibility, that manager responsibility, looking over things, is where we get this descriptive word bishop. And so, in the New Testament, the elders were the bishops as well. It just described one of their responsibilities to oversee. And again, if you are part of a church that you have elders and you have a bishop or bishops, and those are separate things, well, that's not the way it was in the New Testament. Someone after that time came and separated those. And so, in an effort to get back and follow the biblical pattern, in the Church of Christ, we have elders who pastor and they bishop. But let's talk a little bit about submission. Suffering and submission. When a church suffers, when a church is going through a difficult time, and I'm not talking about Dave's having a difficult time and Kent's going through something, I'm talking about all of us together, we're being hit hard. What's going to help
a church during times of suffering? Well, the answer is up there. Submission. But indeed, as we take a look at what Peter is talking about here, elders who submit. Elders who, number one, submit to God. And then, as well, submit to the flock, to the church. And that's one of the things I really want to emphasize as we talk about elders, as we talk about leaders. That if there's an elder that believes in this idea that he's the elder or they are the elders and it's your job to submit to us and that's as far as it goes, watch out, you're going to be in trouble. You're going to be in trouble. Because it works both ways. And this is what we get into and talk about before: servant leadership. Elders need to understand that they are servants. And they are there to serve the congregation. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. So that's what he talks about. That as this church is going through suffering, elders need to submit. And as well, the members need to submit to those elders. And so let's talk about some of the keys to elder submission. Number one, he says they are to work, but not under compulsion. Voluntarily. Now, I want to say a few things here. Now, I recognize, I hope you understand, I recognize we do not have elders here. But I told you that we need to talk about this. And we're going to talk about, we're going to study from time to time, because that needs to be a goal of this congregation. It absolutely needs to be a goal. It needs to be something to talk about. It's something we need to encourage one another in. That one day we can again have elders like we've had for several years in the past. But in that, I want us to say that this is not a lesson that, okay, we don't have elders, and so it doesn't really apply. Because the reality is that even though not all men are qualified to be elders, and some men will never be elders, that does not mean that you are not a Christian leader. All of us are leaders in the sense, number one, of ourselves and our relationship with God. That takes leadership. We may not think of it in that term because it's us and God. But that also, in that relationship with God, affects our relationship with others. And there is principles of leadership that can be applied to that. Number two, if you are married, as a man, you are the head of your house. And that's leadership. If you have children, then you are father, and that is a role of leadership. And the fact that you're a Christian makes you a leader in a sense in our community as you try to let your light shine. And so this is not a sense that, oh, well, I'm not a leader because I'm not an elder. You absolutely are. And I want to emphasize this lesson in that regard as well. So he says one of the keys to elders' submission is a desire to do it voluntarily, not under compulsion. Now, kind of the funny thing is I've talked to several elders, and I think this is kind of understandable, that I think deep down they would say, yes, I desire this work. Yes, I do it voluntarily. But in a sense, at the beginning, there might have been some compulsion in the fact that if they didn't agree to do it, there wouldn't be an eldership. There was some pressure there. Because without them agreeing to do it, there would not be an eldership. And in that regard, there's a little bit of compulsion. There's a little bit of pressure. But I'm not sure that that's exactly what he's talking about. What he's talking about is if you agree to it, you have to want to do that. You have to do the work. You can imagine, if you will, an elder who really doesn't want to do it, he just comes kicking and screaming. Well, he is not going to be a good elder because he doesn't have that motivation, doesn't have that desire that's crucial. So this is an important point. But I also want to look at it from this standpoint. That I think some men have this idea that because I don't have any desire to be an elder, that I'm not qualified and I don't have to worry about that anymore, and that's a done deal, but close. But I want to look at it from this standpoint. As a way of encouragement, as a way of motivation, if you're a Christian man that loves Jesus Christ with all your heart, soul, and mind, God is everything to you. He comes first. He is number one. The fact that you don't have a will to serve God in that capacity, if that's the only qualification that keeps you away from that, there might be a question as to, is there something missing there in my relationship to God that I don't have that desire? Why is it I don't have that desire if Jesus is my all in all? And I'm not trying to put that as a pressure point, but I think it's something honestly that needs to be to look at from men, Christian men, from that standpoint. So is it, oh, I just don't want to, I don't think it's that easy. And it shouldn't be that easy. There needs to be a little more reflection on that. Number two, he says they are to work according to the will of God. And this is kind of the balance of leadership, of eldership, that elders have a work to do, and they have been given authority by the Lord to do it, and there are certain things that they have to do and certain decisions that have to be made. But in the same regard, they're not authorized to just do anything, to come up with all these things. In essence, their authority is limited. Their authority has already been constructed by the Lord Jesus Christ. And that's what they're embracing, and that's what they're doing. And I believe Christianity has suffered greatly because men in leadership positions and all sorts of churches have stepped beyond the realms of their authority and the will of God. Elders who have introduced musical instruments in the worship service, I heard a group of elders who took a survey of the congregation about that, and nobody in the congregation had a problem with it, so they did it. They have no authority to do that. Elders who allow women to take roles of leadership, become fellow elders, become preachers, they have no authority for that. That's not within their realm. And that's truly poor leadership and poor decision making. And so, they do have authority. But elders need to recognize their structure of what God wants has already been created. There's no evolution there of their duties. So they are to work, but they are to work voluntarily and according to the will of God. Number three, they are to work with eagerness and not for sordid gain. And that's one of the interesting things that we've kind of gotten away from. But in the biblical times, the New Testament times, there were a number of elders who, like an evangelist, did it full time. And they were supported by the church to be an elder. And so they were worthy of double honor. They were worthy of their wages. And someone might look at kind of elders today and say, well, I know there's a lot of time, but can they, you know, is that a full-time job? Well, I think that goes back to something we've kind of lost, and that is that in New Testament times, the elders were chief teaching elders. And they spent a lot of time pastoring and overseeing by teaching. And there's a lot of teaching. And in other words, they had evangelists, but they didn't put it all on him. And so I think that a full-time elder was an elder that did a lot of teaching. And so he says they are to do their work with great eagerness and not for sordid gain. I try to think about what would be the sordid gain, but, you know, and the only thing I really come up with is that elders that become elders for simply the money. It's some easy way to make money. In like regard, there's some young men that get into preaching. You know, they get out of college and they're kind of afraid of the whole working world and, you know, oh, well, I'll just get into preaching and then I just got to teach 2 Bible classes and 2 sermons and, boy, that's an easy way to make money. Well, it's not really that easy. And if that's your motivation in becoming a preacher or an elder, that's the wrong motivation. And I think that's kind of the idea of the sort of gain there. They're not really in it for the relationship with God to serve the church. They're in it for the gain. But one of the things that really is difficult about this passage is this, where he says they are not to lord over the flock, but to prove to be examples. And I think that's one of the big teaching roles of elders as well. Do I think they verbally taught? Yes, I do. But I think as well they taught through their example. That they did not expect the congregation to do something they weren't willing to do themselves. So I wanted to flesh this out a little bit, because I've seen it both sides. I've seen elders do what I believe lording over the church. And I think here's a good example of it. There were a group of elders who decided to hire a new preacher. And they hired this new preacher without ever bringing him in and having him preach or teach for the congregation. So they hired him sight unseen. And some questioned the elders about that. And they basically said, well, we're the elders. We know what's best for the congregation. We're going to do this no matter what they say. So it wouldn't be any helpful if we got their feedback, because we're going to hire him anyway. And that's what they did. To me, that's a good example of lording over. It's kind of what we talked about this morning. We're in control. And we're going to do it our way. Well, whether you're talking about eldership or you're talking about just leadership, hearing back, getting feedback from the flock, I think is so vital. Acts chapter 6, you see an example of that by the apostles and their leadership. We have tried several times to get feedback from the congregation on various things. Hopefully that's helpful. Hopefully you appreciate that. But I've seen it on the other side as well. Well, elders really haven't lorded over the flock, but they have been accused of it. Some weird and wrong ideas that Christians have. For example, I've heard Christians say elders have no authority to make decisions, and as soon as they do, they're lording over the flock. That's what that means. That's just so strange. I'm not even sure if we need to go any further than that. But take a look at it from the standpoint. He's a shepherd. Shepherds never make decisions for the flock. No, they absolutely do. That's not lording over the flock. They have the authority. That's part of their role, is to make decisions. Now, can they make decisions like I just illustrated, where they are lording over the flock? Yes, they can. But the fact that they make decisions at all is not a lording over. Number two, I've heard Christians say, I don't have to submit to their decision if I don't like it. I only submit if I do agree with it. That's exactly what we talked about this morning. Control issues. I'm only going to do what I agree. Well, that's not the submission that he talks about as far as the congregation submitting to the elders. You don't always have to agree with the elders. And that's one of the things about being a Christian. There are times where you submit even when you don't agree with it.
But we have to realize that maybe it is better to do it this way. Maybe their decision is the right decision.
Now, could they be lorded over by making decisions? Yeah. Let's take a look at this one as well. If I don't like the decision the elders make, they have to step down. I've heard this.
Well, could there be a situation where elders have made decisions and because of those decisions they need to step down?
Yeah.
But it's not because I don't like that. It's because they're unscriptural decisions. That's the point.
But Christians get these weird ideas. Well, I didn't like what they did, and so now they're lording over, now they're not qualified, and so they got to step down. Crazy stuff. I've heard this. I've had trouble with elders in the past, so I just won't place membership where there are elders.
I'm sorry that people have had problems, and maybe it's legitimate problems with elders in the past.
But that doesn't mean you can take the pattern of Jesus Christ and just throw it out the window. Right? And what happens in these situations is you have a Christian or a couple or whoever this is that's saying this, and one of two things happen. They become permanent visitors. They come all the time, but they never interact with the congregation. They never place their membership. Or they become church hopping, and they just kind of hop from church to church. You'll see them once in a while. But they do that never to get too close to any congregation.
Well, some people even make ridicule the whole thing about placing membership, association with the congregation. Well, there definitely is a biblical pattern there. The best place there is Acts 9 with Saul, who there clearly was some verbal statement to the congregation that he wanted to associate. He wanted to work and worship with the congregation in Jerusalem. Remember that? And they said no. They didn't trust him. And then Barnabas got up and he defended Paul and said everything, he's legitimate and he's sincere. And then they said yes. But I want you to look at it from this standpoint as well. If elders are responsible not only for themselves, but their shepherding of the flock, and that they're going to have to answer to God how they shepherd that flock, if you're an elder, wouldn't you want to know who you're responsible for? You got somebody just come once in a while, permanent visitor. Am I responsible for that person? And that's another role of this place of membership, so that, number one, elders understand who they are responsible for in their shepherding and their oversight. But even congregations that don't have elders, we are responsible for one another. Am I my brother's keeper? Absolutely, you are. We can't just sit here and say, well, we don't have elders. We don't have any responsibility for spiritual guidance of members, especially members that are wayward. So we need to know who is part of this congregation.
And so this is just another thing, that crazy thing that Christians come up with sometimes. And then finally, I've heard this. Well, we've done fine without elders. Why do we need them?
And I think we realize this is not a leave it or take it. It's not a suggestion of Jesus Christ. The apostles did not go around and appoint elders in every church because, well, it just worked in the first century. I mean, if you use that logic, Catholics can say, we don't need elders. We've got the Pope that's working just fine. Mormons can say, we don't need to change. These 18-year-old elders are doing just fine. There's only one reason a congregation should be without elders.
that is that at that present time, they don't have men that are qualified. There's some crazy things Christians come up with.
Not to submit to elders. And a lot of times what they come up with is, because of this, the elders are lording over. And I would imagine situations like this have tainted that whole way we look at eldership. We don't look at the role of elders as something that young men aspire to. We don't look at it as a great job, a great work. A lot of times we look at it as just a position where people just get dumped, the elders just get all the negativity. And I say that to our shame, not this country, but as our brotherhood as a whole.
James Coffin says of this lording over, the English version here is somewhat too strict for the Greek and for the sense. In other words, the New Testament clearly teaches that in a sense, limited of course, the elders are lords or rulers over their congregations. But what is prohibited here is not the exercise of their lawful authority, but the improper exercise of it. And that's what we have to understand. What is the improper exercise? And what I would say to that is the controlling elders, the unscriptural elders that are making unscriptural changes, that don't care about the flock at all, and just going to do whatever they want to do. Zurer in his commentary says that if a man considers the church as his own, then he is indeed likely to rule in an improper manner. The desire for power is an ever-present threat to every congregation on earth. And I wanted to make this point, connecting with this morning's lesson about controlling issues. To keep from the controlling person is not going to the other extreme to where you never want what you think is right, what you want to be the ending conclusion. You just become this passive person. That's not the answer to that. And when we look at elders, that's it. Elders are those that have to make decisions. They have to be examples. They have to put things in order. There's work to do and conclusions to be made. And Christians will be motivated to do this and that. But in the same regard, they can't be controlling them. And so I wanted to make that clear that I wasn't teaching today that Christians are just back themselves in the corner and they don't have any type of will at all. That's not the answer to that. And elders are a good example of that. They have to take leadership, they have to make decisions, they have to bring conclusions, but not in a controlling, lording way. So let's just very quickly take a snapshot look as we close about the authority of the work of elders. Acts 18. The elders of Jerusalem were consulted and asked to make a conclusion about the Gentiles. They did that by obtaining evidence of what God's will was concerning the Gentiles and salvation. Acts 11, verse 30. Money was given to elders to distribute to the needy saints of their church. That is decision making. They decided how much each person, each family, based on their decision, how much need there was. That's authority they have. Titus 1, verse 5, verse 10 and 11. Titus was to appoint elders to help silence rebellious men teaching falsity. There's your teaching elders, that authority. Acts 14, 23, Titus 1, verse 5. Paul and Barnabas appointed elders in every church. They had authority and responsibility for that church that they were placed over, not any other church. It's localized, autonomous leadership. James 5, verse 14, elders were called when a man was sick that they may pray over. Isn't it right? It wasn't, hey, call your brother, your brethren No, it was specifically called the elders. There's some designation of power, authority, ability there. 1 Peter 5, verse 5, young men are exhorted to submit to the elders. And the key of all of that is humility. And I do want to read that because I want to emphasize the other side of it, not just the elders. But look at verse 5. You younger men, likewise, be subject to your elders. And all of you, clothe yourselves with humility to one another. And in verse 6, he says, therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. And what does he do? He looks to the future. Here's the thing. That he may exalt you at the proper time. And finally, to go along with that, we won't read them, but you can look at Hebrews 13, 17, 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 12 to 13, where Christians are told to submit, not just when they agree, but to submit to their leaders. When you're going through a difficult time, it's absolutely crucial, not just then, but definitely during those times, for there to be submission in the church. The church does not belong to us. We must understand that it is a complete privilege and blessing to be part of. And that's my lesson tonight. If you would take a song, we'll turn a song of invitation. I want to end with motivation. What would motivate a Christian to be willing to suffer for doing what is right? What would motivate a Christian to submit to leadership that perhaps in one or two things he doesn't agree with? In other words, what motivation does a Christian have for doing the right thing when the right thing is the hard thing to do? Well, let me tell you this story to help us understand our motivation that we have. I want you to notice these two men. On the right here, we have Ed Leonard. Now, Ed Leonard was an oil driller, 60 years old, who back in 1998 took a job with a drilling company that was based out in Columbia, South Carolina. He was hired over the phone, got on a plane, went down there. On June 24, 7 days after he arrived in Columbia, he was taken captive by armed rebels who demand a ransom of $500,000 for his freedom. This guy's just down there to work. And he gets taken hostage. On October 6th, the same year, his captors, armed with automatic weapons, kept moving him through the Andes Mountains. During this time, Leonard had to bathe in cold, frigid rivers, live in a tent. In the end, he lost 21 pounds during the ordeal. This has now come to be known as the hostage diet, if anyone's interested. On October 6th of the same year, the guerrillas informed Leonard that he was going to be part of an exchange. This is Robert Reinhardt, the owner of the drilling company. What he decided to do was to fly down there and give himself up so that his employee, Ed Leonard, could go home safely to his family. You see, they didn't have any guarantees that they were going to be safe. He's the owner of the company. But he took the place of Ed Leonard so that Ed Leonard could have his freedom. Again, what do you think went through Ed Leonard's mind when all of that happened? The good news is eventually Norbert Reinhardt also was set free and made it home safely. But brothers of Christ, we need to understand we are Ed Leonard. But we're not innocent. We were captive to our own sin. We deserve to be held hostage. But even in that state, Jesus Christ came and he took our place. He took our place so that we could go home and we could be safe. And we don't have to worry about being hostage to sin anymore. But here's the great news. Jesus eventually made it home. Safe, exalted, on the throne. And he's waiting us there. And so tonight we offer this invitation. If anyone has not given control over to Jesus, has not submitted to the chief shepherd, as Peter says, if you're doubting whether you're going to have that unfading crown of glory, let's do something about that tonight. As together we